Not going to be a lot of preaching, folks, so if you came for preaching, you're going to be disappointed. It's going to be a lot of studying, however. It's going to be a lot of testing or just evaluations. Our goal is to present information, to involve you in the learning of that information, and then evaluate each other's processing of that information in a so what sort of way. There is the great risk tonight that you're going to say, whoosh, what is he talking about? You're going to think, I'm back in history class. But what we really want to focus on is that the Bible is telling us three things. The Old Testament is telling us someone is coming. And every book of the Old Testament in some way is focusing our attention on that coming someone. The New Testament is telling us someone has come and someone is coming again. We're coming back. And so our focus is to get ready for that someone's coming. And we need to understand a sequence of events in God's unfolding plan, how that someone would come and why he would come and what he would do for us that we could not do for ourselves. We welcome all of you. But I must say, if you'll allow me just a moment, I welcome my wife and my daughters. You know, some people drive a long way to have a class. They drove 650 miles today. But actually, I think it was more to see grandparents. But anyway, we're glad that they've come. Glad that you've come from other places. It's very encouraging to be among other evangelists and young men that I deeply respect and learn a lot from. And it's rather intimidating to stand before them as well as older men. But it is a privilege because there's no one like a fellow preacher to encourage you in teaching the gospel. So we've got a good bit of work to do. And I think probably what we need to do is open our Bible. We encouraged you last night to bring your textbook. We also ask you to please bring a pen or a pencil. You're going to be seeing the need for those in just a few minutes. The more senses we can involve in the learning process, the greater the retention. And so we're going to appeal to you from a visual standpoint as you read. We may be asking some of you men, if you're comfortable with it, to go ahead and orally read so that we can hear the word. And we're going to be seeing some visual demonstrations of what it might have looked like when these Bible characters interacted. And we're going to be writing some things down, so we're going to be feeling and seeing it as well. So you're going to need to bring this booklet of material every evening. You're going to notice in the course of the study that Ezra is broken up, that you're not going from Ezra 6 to Ezra 7. In fact, you're going from Ezra 6 to Esther. And you may already be scratching your head, why are we doing that? Because chronologically in time, Esther fits between Ezra 6 and Ezra 7. So we're wanting you to get sequence in mind. I don't really care if you remember the dates. If you do, that's great. But if you don't, that's okay. But it is important for you to remember sequence of events because God has a very unique plan and He's working out His plan to save a people to bring His Son into the world. So that's what we're going to be looking at. And we're going to be doing a good bit of review tonight. And that's going to be a building block for the rest of the week. So kind of hang with me here the first few minutes. As we say, oh yeah, I remember back when I was a kid, we studied that. And so we're going to be looking at a period of time when we had Saul, David, and Solomon in a united kingdom. And after Solomon's reign, when Rehoboam acted foolishly, Jeroboam took 10 of the tribes to the north, and Judah and Benjamin were in the south. And so we call that not the United Kingdom, but the Divided Kingdom. And so in about 722, 721, please give me a year or so in there, 722, 721, there's this nation from the east and from the north that swoops down and takes Israel into captivity, Assyrian captivity. And then Judah is left alone for another 140 years or so, and then another nation is going to swoop from the east and take them into captivity in a process of about three different carryings away. Who is that nation that takes them into captivity? That's Babylon, right? I remember this congregation has a lot of good students of the Bible. But what we must do as we build on these biblical facts is they have to change us. It does us no good to simply remember a lot of facts. If they don't transform us into the people of God, they're useless. So I don't want to criticize these good knowledge that you have, but let's remember then, where might we read about these Assyrians taking the 10 northern tribes into captivity? Where in our Old Testament might we read? Give me just maybe a book or a couple books. Okay, that'd be pretty specific. 2 Kings in chapter 17 would be where we would read about those events in about 722, 721. Now, where would be maybe a good summary for us to read why the tribe of Judah, the southern kingdom, is taken into captivity? Where might be a good summary passage for us to start with? Any ideas? Second, that's good. Second Chronicles. Let's go to 2 Chronicles 36. In 2 Chronicles chapter 36, we're going to see a bunch of names that I'll probably butcher. I have a friend who was talking with a Jewish fellow one time, and he was talking about Leviticus, and he was talking about Nadab and Abihu. And the Jewish man said, "Nadab and Abihu, I don't remember them." And he said, "Oh, you mean Nadab and Abihu." So we're probably just butchering those names. Like last night I was talking about Akiva. For years I called him Akaba. But anyway, we know who we're talking about. And so if I just say those guys, just work with me, okay? So a bunch of these J names you've got in chapter 36. Significant event, about 609 BC, there was a really good king. And he was going to go and he was going to try to stop the Egyptians as they were coming to interact with the Babylonians. His name was Josiah. Josiah dies there at that battle at Carchemish. And then what we have is the king of Egypt in verse 3 of chapter 36. He's going to take Jehoahaz, that 23-year-old, and he's not going to last long at all, 3 months in Jerusalem. And so then there is a payoff to the Egyptians. And then we see Jehoiakim in verse 5, he's about 25 years old, and he reigns for 11 years. Now we're getting down to a time at about 605 BC, and then we're going to move on down for about 11 years, on down to 597. Jehoiakim's going to last 11 years. And then what we're going to notice then in verse 9 is Jehoiachin. He's got about three different names. He's 8 years old, and he reigns, how long does he last? 3 months and 100-day reign. All right, one of those short reigns. Right? He just doesn't last long. Nebuchadnezzar's going to take him into captivity. Now, Nebuchadnezzar's who? Who's this Nebuchadnezzar guy? King of Babylon. And he is now the rising power, and he's taking away these small puppet kings down in Judah. And then who's this next king? He's going to last for about 11 years. Anybody want to venture? If you want to say another guy or just the Z guy. Zedekiah. All right, Zedekiah. And so we've got him at 21 years old, and then we're coming on down. And why is all this happening? Why is God allowing these Babylonians, who are fierce and wicked people, to come and take away His special people, the Jewish people? Why is He allowing them to be so treated? Sins, evil, wickedness. Hear all those names going out. And now notice in verse 12, though God's been having some people say, now you need to turn around. You need to quit this stuff. You need to quit this idolatry. You remember what happened up in Israel? You need to change. Who's a prophet who's... He does a lot of crying. Jeremiah, he laments. In fact, later he's going to lament at the destruction of Jerusalem. And so Jeremiah is one of these prophets, but there are other prophets in the time period. Do you remember a guy by the name of... I'll tell you in Hungarian, Habakkuk. Habakkuk. Habakkuk, he's saying, God, you need to do something about this wickedness around here. God says, I'm going to bring the Babylonians. And Habakkuk says, but they're worse than we are. He says, I know. But after I use them, then I'm going to punish them. So there are other prophets in the time, but Jeremiah is a prominent one, and he's going to prophesy for 40, 50 years. And so Jeremiah is speaking for the Lord and telling them about their evil. And we're going to notice then in verse 14, there's some people who particularly are identified as those who are wicked. Who in verse 14 are the particularly ones that are identified as being wicked? Yeah, priests. Priests and the people. So it's a broad accusation. They're very unfaithful, the abominations of the nations. They're defiling the house of the Lord, which He had sanctified in Jerusalem. So we think about some other prophets who are not back home. Some other prophets have already been deported about this time. Who was taken at about 605? Good-looking young fellow, really smart and all that stuff. With four of them. Daniel and his three friends, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, isn't it? Of course, we remember Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they're taking. And now in 597... the second group is taken with about 10,000, some of the craftsmen, some of the people that are good at building. They're taken, and there's about 10,000 living along a river. I'm going to call it Chebar, if that's okay. Who's the prophet that's talking to them? That's Ezekiel. Okay, so all this is going on at this time. But God's telling His people that I still love you. I still care about you. I still am going to have compassion on my people and on my dwelling place. But what are the people continually doing in verse 16? They're mocking the messengers of God. Oh, Jeremiah, you know what you're talking about. We'll just throw you in a pit. We'll just starve you out. We'll just see how you do in your prophesying when you get no bread. And so they scoffed at God's prophets until it got to a point that there was no what? There's no remedy. They are turning God away. They are rejecting God's message over and over and over. He says, that's it. That's all. You're gone. Forever? Are you gone forever? Are you going to be kicked out? Is God never going to have anything to do with His people anymore? How long are we going to be gone? 70 years. Now, how do you know that? Where'd you get this 70-year stuff? Okay, Jeremiah. Let's go ahead and turn there. Jeremiah chapter 29. We could do it in chapter 25, but 29 will do it just fine. Jeremiah then in chapter 29 is telling the people, help me with some verses here. Chapter 29. Remember, in this case, Jeremiah is writing about the time Jeconiah is taken into captivity, about 597, you notice in verse 2 of chapter 29. So he's writing a letter to the people who've been taken captive, and he says, you might as well make yourself at home, because you're going to be here a while. Going to be here. Well, oh no, Hananiah says it's just going to be 2 years and we'll be back. No, that's not how it's going to happen. So, how long are they going to be in captivity then? Verse 10, 70 years have been completed for Babylon. Then I'll visit you and fulfill my good word to you and bring you back to this place. For I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans for welfare, not for calamity. To give you a future and hope, that you'll call upon my name, that you allow me to penetrate your heart, that you'll come to be truly my people, not by genealogy, but by faith. And so, you might as well settle down, because you're going to be here a while. But I've got a plan for you. You've got a future and a hope. But for now, you're going to be captive people of the Babylonians. So, as we're getting ready to finish up 2 Chronicles 36 then, in 586, 587, 586, around there, Nebuchadnezzar says, I've had it with you people. You keep telling me you're going to be loyal to me. I set up a governor like Zedekiah, and he says he'll be loyal to me. And everybody keeps rebelling against me. So Nebuchadnezzar brings his forces in, puts a siege on the city of Jerusalem, and he does what to the temple? He just destroys it. He levels it. And he destroys the city for all intents and purposes. And so who's left now in Judea? Who's left in Judea now? Very few, the poorest of the people. And who do they drag off with them? Jeremiah. Jeremiah says, don't go. Don't go to Egypt. Stay here. They won't listen. They drag him off with them. We don't know what happened to Jeremiah for sure. But boy, he had a miserable life. There were times when he said, I'm not preaching anymore. I've had enough. People won't listen to me anyway. And when he said, I'm not going to say anything more about it, he said, it's like a fire in my bones. Shut up and I cannot contain it. And so that's our setting. But about 100, 150 years before this, God's been telling them, I've got some plans. And I've got some people. I've already named them. There's somebody that's going to come back. There's somebody that's going to rebuild. There's somebody that's going to send you home. Who's that somebody? Cyrus. But later, it'll really be the Christ. And every one of the prophets points to Him. So notice as we get then to verse 22 of 2 Chronicles 36. Now it's in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia. Wouldn't it be helpful to know when that was? Wouldn't it be nice to just kind of have a Bible that tells you, oh, that's such and such a day? Well, mine's all scribbled around. And even today I thought, I've got a wrong date up there. I had to mark through it. Wasn't matching with what the text was saying. The text is right, not my scribble. But we're looking now at a period of about 539 B.C. when Cyrus is on the throne. And I heard that pen click as Jeff said, I'm going to write that in my margin. That's what Bibles are for, folks, to write it. If you're an adult. I understand when you're telling your children don't write in your Bible. But we're in the adults. So here we are, and God's been saying something about fulfilling the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah. But is there another prophet that's been telling that Cyrus is my man? Cyrus is the one I've named. Is there another prophet telling something about that? Boy, now it would be handy to write down Isaiah chapter 44 and verse 28. That'd be real helpful to have right there. Because I assure you, I wouldn't remember it if I didn't have it written down in the margin or hadn't tried to study hard today. So Isaiah 44, 28 through chapter 45 about verse 4 tells us and names Cyrus as God's shepherd. Cyrus, a Persian, a shepherd of God, as he shepherds God's people back to their homeland. Now you're thinking, wait a second. I thought this outline said Ezra. We haven't been to Ezra yet. Oh, yes, we have. Would you read the first couple of verses of Ezra in chapter 1 after you've read 2 Chronicles 36, verses 22 and 23? I'll tell you what we'll do. Courtney, do you have chapter 36, 22 and 23? Would you read it? Gary, would you read chapter 1 of Ezra, the first couple verses? That sounds similar. You'd almost think that maybe Ezra must have been writing both of those things. Don't know for sure, but he may have been the chronicler. And I might just share with you for a minute. You think, well, Chronicles is saying the same thing as the Kings. No, it's not. The chronicler is focusing more on the spiritual condition of the people. Now, there are exceptions. The chronicler is speaking more on the Levitical viewpoint than the Kings. You don't have just all battles and warfare and blood and guts. You have a lot about what's happening to the people spiritually in the Chronicles that's not always recorded in the Kings. But I want you to notice the connection between 2 Chronicles and Ezra, just as if, oh, let me repeat that. Does that remind you of any couple of books in the New Testament where it's almost like the same writer is writing because when he finishes one, he just steps right into the next? Luke and Acts. And so notice then our situation. There ought to be some notes at the top of your Bible here in Ezra. Maybe something such as 2 Chronicles 36, 22 and 23 by verse 1. And you might want to note, you may have a center column reference Bible, which is really helpful, because we're reading about these things by the mouth of Jeremiah, and it would be real helpful if you could highlight or underline Jeremiah 25 or Jeremiah 29, because when somebody's asking you, well, what's this talking about? Oh, well, let's go back and read. And then it would be helpful to have Isaiah 44 penciled or penned in somewhere along the list. Two or three other things would be real helpful. As you open your booklet and you start putting together some of these sequences in the yellow page, some things that would be helpful at the top of your Bible, if you have room, would be to kind of chronicle these events that we're going to be reading about in this book of Ezra. It might be helpful to put about 538 to 536, and you might just put a Z by it for Zerubbabel. It might be helpful to put about 484, 485 for Esther, and maybe 458, 457 for Ezra, and 445, 444 for Nehemiah. Now you're saying, wait a second, now you went way too fast. It's all on the next page in your documentation. Okay? So well, why didn't you just tell us that? Because you'll remember it better if you'll write it down for yourself. So how much do we learn about Ezra in the first six chapters of the book of Ezra? How much do we learn about Ezra in the first six chapters of the book of Ezra? Zilch. It's not talking about Ezra. We're not going to learn about Ezra until we get to chapter 7. But we are going to talk about spiritual leadership. Yesterday we talked about Barnabas, we talked about Jesus, and we talked about how to deal with people who seek to change or pervert God's Word, and how critical it is for men of God, if they're going to be spiritual leaders, to have a woman of God at their right hand. That's not absolutely essential, but it is a tremendous help. So, we're about ready to get started. You think, oh no, this was the introduction? Well, we'll do some work together and learn some things. Notice on that second page in regard to the chronology of the Persian period, we're going to be looking at fellows like Cyrus. We've met him. We're not going to spend much time, if any, with Cambyses or Cambyses. You're welcome to your pronunciation. Darius or Darius, we're going to be noticing him tonight. And we're going to read about Xerxes, particularly tomorrow night in the story of Esther. And we're going to read Artaxerxes in our listing tonight in this first half of the book of Ezra. So those are going to be names that you're going to be seeing in our study so that you can point this to some historical hitching post. The third page can be confusing, but the third page basically tells you what's going on in time. It's going to tell you approximate dates up at the top. It's going to point out two views of that 70-year period. And then it's going to show you what's happening in regard to the returns, the book of Ezra, book of Esther, and the book of Nehemiah. So that can be helpful to you so that you can see the sequencing of events as they unfold. The elders asked that I would speak on the subject of spiritual leadership. Why in the world choose Ezra, Esther, and Nehemiah? If we want to know what spiritual leadership is about, we don't have to read Stephen Covey. He's got some good stuff. But we do need to read the Word of God, because he shows us what it takes to survive spiritually, and not just survive, but thrive in a wicked and perverse world. And he shows us foundational principles in the lives of Zerubbabel, Jeshua, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, Nehemiah, and Ezra, and Esther, that can change our world as it did theirs. Leaders are not born, they are made. There are some natural abilities that are real helpful. My dad unflatteringly says about me, he's got the gift of gab. And I can't deny it. That can be very detrimental, in fact. But there is abundant good lumber here. If you want to be a leader of God's people in appropriate roles, whether you're male or female, you can be. God will empower you to be the leader you need to be in your proper role and relationship if you want to be that. But you must understand that it will be God's working in you. You're not going to be a spiritual leader simply because I want to be a spiritual leader. It's God's will that is imperative. And we're on our knees a lot to know that will. And we're in the book a lot to know our God so that we can see ourselves as He sees us and He is our enabler. But a second reason for a study like this is that these books teach us about restoration and renewal. When these people come home, there is nothing. It has all been decimated. It is all charred black ashes. And they're being asked to start building again from nothing, except they have a pattern. They have the law which instructs them how to do what most of them have probably never seen done in their lives. But when they go back to God's pattern, they can rebuild. And they're effective leaders of restoration. So let's talk about one other fellow here that we haven't dealt with very much. Let's look at this leader of the people by the name of Zerubbabel. As you get down in chapter 1, let's just quickly read through chapter 1 of Ezra, and then we'll take a little break and do some review. Chapter 1, now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he sent a proclamation throughout all the kingdom and also put it in writing, saying, "Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build him a house in Jerusalem," which is in Judah. "Whoever there is among you of all his people, may his God be with him. Let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. And every survivor, at whatever place he may live, let the men of that place support him with silver and gold, with goods and cattle, together with a freewill offering for the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. Then the heads of the fathers' households of Judah and Benjamin, and the priests and the Levites arose, even everyone whose spirit God had stirred to go up and rebuild the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem. And all those about them encouraged them with articles of silver, with gold, with goods, with cattle, with valuables, aside from all that was given as a free will offering. Also King Cyrus brought out the articles of the house of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and put in the house of his gods. And Cyrus, king of Persia, had them brought out by the hand of Mithridat, the treasurer, and he counted them out to Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. Now this was their number: 30 gold dishes, 1,000 silver dishes, 29 duplicates, 30 gold bowls, 410 silver bowls of a second kind, and 1,000 other articles. All the articles of gold and silver numbered 5,400. Sheshbazzar brought them all up with the exiles who went up from Babylon to Jerusalem. Did you read a lot about Zerubbabel in that? Zerubbabel, I never even found the name. I know, that's confusing. Because when we get to chapter 2, we read in verses 1 and 2, "Now these are the people of the province who came up out of the captive of the exiles whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away to Babylon and returned to Jerusalem and Judah, each to his city. These came with Zerubbabel, Jeshua, Nehemiah, and those guys." All right. Now, where's this Zerubbabel guy fit in? I tell you, I have some struggles with that, but I want you to look at a couple of places. Look in the book of Matthew, chapter 1, and verse 12. In the book of Matthew, in chapter 1, and verse 12. Keep a finger there in Ezra, chapter 1. And while you're turning to Matthew 1, 12, one of you men, when you get there, just go ahead and read it for all of us. Matthew 1, and verse 12. I knew it'd be that way. Everybody's waiting for somebody else. Randy, you got it? Read it, please. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Just say those guys. But now I'm looking for one name. You see a name there I might be looking for? Zerubbabel's in there. All right, that's the only one I'm looking for. I don't know how to pronounce all these others. I'm probably not getting that one right. But Zerubbabel is related to somebody. You see this chronological point? Look back a little bit. Who might he be related to? Ah, Josiah. So we see kind of a kingly, princely reign. Do you notice how Sheshbazzar is referred to in chapter 1 of Ezra? Prince of Judah. Notice in Ezra chapter 3, verse 8. In Ezra chapter 3 and verse 8. Now I know why none of you guys volunteered. I had forgotten about all those names. Ezra 3 and in verse 8. Here's the second year of their coming to the house of God at Jerusalem. In the second month, Zerubbabel, the son of, I'm going to say Shealtiel, okay? And that was one of those guys we saw in that list in Matthew 1 and verse 12. So what I'm finding as I read through this material is sometimes they reference Sheshbazzar and sometimes they reference Zerubbabel. As you go on in chapter 5 and in verse 2, you see the same kind of situation. Sometimes they call him Sheshbazzar, sometimes they call him Zerubbabel. My opinion is, being very meager at that, is that we're talking about the same guy. Some people believe that Sheshbazzar is an uncle of Zerubbabel. I don't know how you get that. I would suggest to you it's the same individual. And you know what happens sometimes? If I told you, did you read about Belteshazzar? Well, yeah, you read about Belteshazzar. A good bit in the book of Daniel. But they gave him a different name. There is the possibility that Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel are the same guy, two different names. That's all I know to say. But I would like for you to consider that most of the time, Zerubbabel is the one who is going to be addressed. All right, let's stop. Take a little break here. I've got some questions you don't have. So you just orally answer these. See, nobody's going to... Well, I guess somebody will know. But we're going to do some oral answers to see some things that we've learned. And I realize already I've not given you all the information you need. When the people start coming home, does everybody come home all at once? No. In Ezra chapter 1 through 6, we have about how many people coming home? Roughly. That's on page 1 of your material. Okay. About 50,000 people coming home. They come home in about 538 to 536. That was one of those dates I asked you to write at the top of the page. They come home at the leadership of whom? Who's leading them home? Zerubbabel or Sheshbazzar. And who is the priest who's leading? Joshua or Jeshua, depending upon whether you're reading Haggai or Ezra. So here's this first group coming home, about 50,000 of them, with Zerubbabel and Jeshua. Now, in about 458, 457, there's only going to be less than 2,000 or so come. And who's going to lead them home about 80 years later? That's Ezra. Then there's going to be a very few come with a wall builder in about 445. Who's the wall builder that's going to bring a few home? Nehemiah. All right, now we can answer that question. The Bible records how many groups of Jews returning from Babylonian captivity? How many groups come home? Three groups. We have three groups coming home. What books of the Bible would you read about these returns? What books? Ezra and Nehemiah. But now I heard another name, Haggai and Zechariah. Haggai and Zechariah, we're going to be noticing them briefly, are in 520. They're in the second year of King Darius, and they're going to be talked about in Ezra 1 through 6. So that's where they fit in time. So the first group of returnees are found in Ezra chapters 1 through 6. The approximate date when they went home? 538 to 536. Second group goes home in approximately 458, 457. The leaders, Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah. Now tell me the names of the kings. What are the names of the kings of the Persians who are either helping or hindering these people in rebuilding this city and this temple? Cyrus, Darius, Artaxerxes. Artaxerxes. Those are the ones that are going to be named such as chapter 6 and verse 14. What's the primary objective for this first group coming home? What is their primary work when they go home? What's the king told them to do? Rebuild the temple. That's the particular focus. They're not sent home necessarily to rebuild the city. They're sent home to rebuild the temple. And that's going to be significant as we notice some of the accusations made about them. Ezra's primary goal, as he has set his heart to study the law of the Lord, is to what? When Ezra comes back, is he primarily focusing on kind of finishing up the temple? What's he wanting to accomplish? Restore the hearts to worship the God of heaven. So he wants to teach them the law so that their hearts will be in a right relationship with God. Nehemiah's primary goal is what? What's his primary goal? Get the wall rebuilt. Okay. All right. Now, I think you'll find some questions in your material also. I think it would be good for us just to go ahead and get those out of the way about now. So if you're wondering why this EN11 stuff is on there, that's not some cryptic code. The ABECA posters, some of you may have used them. In fact, I know some of you have used them a lot. These ABECA posters are great. But I don't know that all of you could see them real well from where you are. They were really helpful for us in Hungary. You talk about pictures painting 1,000 words. This is the section on Ezra and Nehemiah. And so we're going to be able to then answer some questions and chronologically follow through the book of Ezra at the same time. So in your questions, question number one, who is the king of Persia when the book of Ezra begins? Who's the king of Persia when the book begins? Write it down, please. Don't mean to be false. Please write it down. Cyrus. And we read about him also in 2 Chronicles 36. What do you think this picture is telling us that he's doing? He's reading a proclamation. He's got his scepter, he's got his proclamation, and he's announcing, the God, Jehovah, has told me to send his people home, to rebuild his house. Well, question number two, what has God appointed him to do? Me and my baby. All right. To rebuild a house, rebuild the house of the Lord. Build him a house in Jerusalem. Why would I have in parentheses there Isaiah 44 and 45? Why would I put that there? Because that's the prophecy. That's the prophecy. Remember, Jeremiah prophesied from about 740 to 690, and Cyrus comes on the scene in 539, so we're looking at least 150 years after God names the man before he steps on the scene of history. Well, what are God's people then invited to do? What are God's people invited to do? Go home. Go home. Well, do you just jump on a plane and go, or how do you get there? Walk. Or you ride some of those thousands of animals we read about. How far is the trip? Any ideas? 100 miles, 200, 300, 700, 800, 900? That's like a good number. Today I read 700 and I also read 900. Long way. It takes them how long to get there? Anybody remember how long it takes them to get there? Let me suggest it's longer than a couple weeks. Let me suggest it's longer than a couple months. It's actually about 4 months to get home. They would be going around the Fertile Crescent. They would not go through the desert. So what did they take when they went home? What did they take with them? Silver, gold, that stuff heavy. Yeah, it's heavy. What else do they take besides silver and gold? Animals? Why would they take animals? Sacrifices? Food. Something to ride on. All right, so did they take anything else with them? Some things that maybe had been taken from them, taken from their temple. Nebuchadnezzar had taken a bunch of stuff, remember, when he destroyed the temple and he kept it in his place. And Cyrus says, you take that back home with you. Did Cyrus help? Did he send any financial backing for them also?
Yes, yes, he did.
So what's the condition then? What's the condition when they get home? Oh, have you ever walked into a house that's just been almost totally burned down and just had to go through the cleanup process? You know how demoralized? It doesn't even have to be your house. But this is the place where the holy God had communed with his people for centuries. This was the great temple that Solomon had built. This was grand with splendor and gold, and they come home to just destroyed and leveled. And so what are they going to need to start doing? What are they going to get to doing right away? They're going to erect something. They're going to erect an altar because they're wanting to petition God. They're wanting to worship God. They're wanting to offer sacrifices to God. They're wanting to focus on God and God's pleasure and God's being with them as they go through this process. And so they begin very early on building a place of worship to God. So, when you start building the temple of God, you've got to start with the foundation. And you didn't pour it, long brothers. You hewed it out of big, long pieces of rock. And it was a very arduous task. Lots of men working, and they're working hard. You can see the young men working and helping as well. And so now, there's a celebration because we got the foundation laid. If you ever build a house, it's just kind of exciting once you get all the that footing poured, and then you get your block just to mark where everything's going to be, and you pour your gravel in, you're getting ready to pour that slab. And, oh, so that's how it's going to be. Here's how it's going to set. Oh, this room's going to be here. And so there is a celebration. There is a concert of celebration among God's people when they get that part done. That's done after about a year or so. We're looking at about 536. They've got that all done. Now, of course, the rest of the work's going to go fast, and they'll be done with the whole project in the next 6 months. Yes? No. No. They're not done. In fact, they're going to be very discouraged because the enemies of God's people are going to do everything in their power to get them to quit. Do the Israelites quit? Yes. For about 15 years, you've got grass growing through the cracks of the foundation because the people have taken their eyes off of God. And Haggai says, consider your ways. You live in paneled houses. You've got you a nice place to live. And look at the temple of God. And Zechariah says in chapter 4, verse 9, do not despise the day of small things, because when that foundation is built, you've got the young people praising and cheering. And what are the old people doing? They are crying and weeping because it is their sins that have caused that place to be destroyed. And now what we've got is this little bitty temple, nothing like what Solomon had. But Zechariah says, don't you think something is small when God says it's great? I'm going to bring my son. I'm going to have my people. I'm going to have my temple. And do not think that this is a small day. This is a great day in the Lord. And so Haggai and Zechariah, as you notice in chapter 5 of Ezra, they support Zerubbabel and Jeshua as they get back to work in about 520. And now within 4 years, they have completed the process. It is done. They are finished. But in the meantime, continued discouragement come from the Samaritans. There are letters written to the king. And discouragement comes and the people are stopped by force of arms. But they start again at the encouragement of Haggai and Zechariah, and they begin rebuilding. And then they say, you can tell this to the king. Cyrus told us to come and build this temple. You take that to the king, and we're going to keep building until you stop us. A change of attitude. They had been complacent. They had been lazy. They had taken their eyes off God, and they had quit working. But then at the teaching of Haggai and Zechariah, and challenging them to reevaluate their priorities, they said, we're going to go to work. And until you stop us by force, we're going to continue to do the work God has given us to do. They changed their focus. They put their eyes on the Lord. And God brought them success. So we need to see what he has done, and we need to see the value of teaching. Haggai and Zechariah did not beat them with the club. They did not simply sing a sad song to them. They told them, you need to reevaluate your priorities. You need to look at God and see His greatness. And so these two men are challenging the people as they speak the Word of God. The records are checked by the king, and they find indeed Cyrus has authorized that. And so by 516, the temple is completed. Well, the so what? As you look at your outline of the material in chapters 1 through 6, as you look at the so what of all of this spiritual leadership, tonight was a lot of information. But that will help us for the rest of the study. I want you to notice from chapter 1, who's invited to go home? Who's invited to go home? Every one of God's people. Everyone is invited to go home. Does everyone go? Do some who choose not to relocate, do they support those who are willing to relocate? Yes, they do. There is just as much work to be done here as there is anywhere else in the world. You don't have to go across the ocean to become evangelistic. You just have to walk next door. In fact, you don't even have to walk next door. You just have to pick up your phone or write a letter or send an email. You can support the work of the Lord and bloom where you're planted. Notice that everyone is important. How many names did you choose to read in chapter 2? They didn't even name them all, did they? But everyone was important. Did God number every person that went back? He knew them all. I'd suggest you knew them all by name, even if we could never pronounce them. And notice in chapter 3 that work on the temple began. That when they got home, they got focused. You know how new Christians are? Man, I'm on fire. I can't read enough tonight. I'll be up 4 hours. I'm going to call everybody I know. 6 months later, what are they doing? Oh, well, the news, the movies, we lose focus. And so the work was opposed. Every time somebody does something for God, Satan is there seeking to discourage it. But the work is resumed, and the work is finished. You know what's sad? When you get to chapter 4 and 5, well, we've been working on this thing for 16 years, but no, we're not done yet. Are there projects in your life you've been working on? 16 years? Nah, not done yet. What's holding you? Why aren't you finished? Sometimes we need a swift kick from Haggai and Zechariah. It helps to get busy. Thank you very much for studying. Hopefully you'll be prepared as we move into Esther and see the great leadership of her and Mordecai, her cousin, tomorrow evening.